A new major publication from Cork University Press illuminates a whole way of life in Ireland which has almost disappeared. It's a social and cultural history of this country, told through the furniture, furnishings and other objects which defined Irish domestic life for centuries. The book is called Irish Country Furniture and Furnishings, 1700 to 2000. The author is Claudia Kinmonth. Claudia, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you've been researching this for decades at this stage, and the book is richly illustrated with wonderful photographs, many of them you took yourself, of the interior of farmhouses and cabins where you just arrived, knocked on the door and said, hey, can I photograph your furniture, please? Why do you think this kind of documentation is important?
Well, when I started doing the work about 30 years ago, people were already telling me that it was too late, that I wouldn't find any traditional, unmodernised interiors. I did prove them wrong, luckily, but it was a lot of work. I went all over Ireland, as you say, knocking on doors and trying to find people who hadn't got stainless steel sinks and hadn't changed their kitchens, and they still had a dresser and a settle and that sort of thing. And it was great fun and very interesting. 30 years later, it's much, much more difficult to find those interiors. So I'm really glad I did it then. And this book brings a lot of that early work into colour now, and it's digitalised, and you know, it's sort of like old wine. It's got better with time, and it's also irreplaceable.
The book also introduces us to a lot of new words, or at least certainly introduced me to a lot of words I hadn't come across before. Words like hornspoon, noggin and clavey. tell us about one piece of furniture, which we don't hear much about today. I mean, I'm familiar with the term, never entirely certain what exactly it meant. The settle bed. What was a settle bed?
The settle bed was a wooden sofa bed, really, which was by the fire usually. It was a bench by day, and by night it could be folded out by means of hinges to form a floor-level, high-sided double bed near the fire, containing its own bedding. So the settle bed took the place of a spare bedroom. It accommodated several children or a couple of people. It was found in all counties of Ireland, all over Ireland, extraordinarily. And it dates right back to the 1640s when I found it in an inventory in County Waterford. So the settle bed was ingenious, it was popular, particularly in houses with very little space, and it was adopted in houses that didn't have spare bedrooms. I mean, it's still relevant and useful today, really. People are reproducing them.
And is it similar in any way to something that they have in America called the Murphy bed?
Yes. In America, Irish emigrants used a different sort of bed, which very often turns up there and became nicknamed a Murphy bed. In Ireland, we called it the press bed. So it was a two-door wardrobe or a two-door cupboard, which opened up, revealing a great big bed, which hinged down from vertical to horizontal. And there was a double bed that hinged out onto the floor. So it took up hardly any floor space during the day. It was perfectly disguised and then became a bed. And there were lots of different disguised beds in the Irish repertoire, but the press bed was called the Murphy bed in America. I suppose in places like Manhattan, where people are very short of space, it was perfectly suited to that environment. And then the Irish introducing it meant that people gave it that lovely nickname, the Murphy bed, as a result.
Something else that caught my eye is that the hanging cradle. Why would a baby's cradle be hung from the roof of a house or the roof of a cabin?
The hanging cradle is a lovely example of people's ingenious, frugal sense of saving space. I came across it with a newspaper, illustrated newspaper called the Pictorial Times, right back in the 1840s, where there were some pictures of people in very poor houses with these hanging cradles with the baby in them, suspended from the roof by two ropes. So you hang the cradle from the roof. I suppose it's like a rectangular box, and it keeps the baby, you know, rocking around happily near the mother's elbow, I suppose, where she can keep an eye on it and keep it moving. And then any animals that are marauding around, the dog, the cat, perhaps some hens, maybe the pig at night if he was brought in, the baby is safe from all those marauding animals, and it's taking up no floor space, which was important because people were in such overcrowded conditions. So the hanging cradle is an amazing object. I've never actually seen one surviving. They've become extinct, if you like. But there they survive in illustrations, and people could remember them in documentation right up to the end of the 20th century, actually. Older people used to talk about them, remark upon them from the 1930s. So The Hanging Cradle was an Irish thing. I mean, actually, it was found historically in other parts of the world, but it's really lovely to imagine that ingenious, extraordinary object, which I think the Health and Safety Department would disapprove strongly of now.
Now, places to store food were obviously very important as well in the days before refrigeration. Tell me about salt boxes and how they were used to preserve food.
The salt box was something, again, it's really historical. You don't come across them in the 20th century much, but salt was really important in people's diet, not only for flavouring a staple diet of potatoes, but for cooking with and for salting down meat and preserving meat. So if you were lucky enough to kill a pig or butcher an animal, instead of putting it in the fridge or the freezer, you'd salt it down and preserve it through salting. And the same with fish. Salt fish was important as well on the coast. So the salt itself was a really centrally important ingredient. And the salt box was quite a large box, I suppose about a foot wide, and it was fixed to the wall, usually very close to the hearth. Even in the back wall of the hearth, you'd find the salt box. And it had a little hinged, sloping wooden lid. It's like a little house, I suppose, one side of a house. So the salt box was sort of symbolic and important way of keeping salt dry.
Tell me then also about something else was important for storing food. That was the meal chest.
The meal chest was like a much larger version of the salt box. Again, it would be near the hearth. And you would store your grain or your flour or your oatmeal, having harvested it, you'd store it from one year to the next in this enormous, great big slope-lidded box, wooden box. And you'd pack it in very tightly to exclude any possibility of mould, keep it all fresh. And there it was. Sometimes it had a hasp and a staple on it, so it could be locked, which is symbolic of the fact that that food was so important for survival between harvests. So that object was very important for keeping life and soul together in the house, really. And I never found any in my fieldwork in the 1980s, but historically they were there, and there are some in museums as well.
Obviously, we can't talk about Irish furnishings without discussing the dresser. Was the dresser the focal point of a house?
Well, the Irish dresser, if you were lucky enough to have a dresser, it was the focal point. It was the most decorative and beautiful point of the Irish kitchen. Not everybody could afford to have a dresser. Sometimes there was a smaller dresser called a hanging dresser, which was like a small shelf hanging on the wall. But if you had a full-size dresser, it was a lovely thing, and it was the thing which displayed all your plates and your crockery, and your spoons even hung in slots on it at eye level. And sometimes you'd put fishing floats along the top if you were living on the coast and had glass fishing floats. So it was the prettiest, loveliest part of the kitchen. The fact that it was placed opposite the front door, when you walked in as a stranger, you'd be immediately impressed by looking at it. Or possibly the other place it would be put in the kitchen would be directly opposite the fire. So in the evening, the firelight would dance across the plates and make it look bright and lovely. And yet in the bottom of it would be utilitarian things like buckets and crocks and maybe even hens kept for their eggs through the winter. So you could have a hen coop in the bottom and plates on the top, which was an amazing combination, I think, of very functional and very aesthetic simultaneously.
You also devote quite a bit of space to chairs, to a wide variety of chairs, but the most interesting, I think, are chairs with woven straw seats. Tell me a little bit about those, because they're obviously an alternative to seats made of wood.
Well, there were Sugorn chairs, which were wooden chairs with straw seats, and then there were completely straw chairs, which were woven straw chairs, which are very complex and very wonderful and extraordinarily rare. But the Sugorn chair had a sort of a ladder back construction, a rudimentary wooden frame, and then it had straw rope wrapped around to make a seat. And the reason this became so popular was because we were terribly short of timber in Ireland. By the 18th century, people were lamenting the loss of timber. It was badly deforested and actually still is today. So this was a really good way of making comfortable chairs by using hardly any timber. And the straw rope itself, or sugorn, twisted straw or hay rope, was a single twisted strand made by two people simultaneously. That straw rope was used for everything from tying down thatch against the Atlantic winds, tying down haycocks, even making horse harness, everything that you'd use rope for, sugorn was used for. So when they used it for the chair seat, it had a particular pattern of weave that was repeated again and again, and you could replace the Suguan seat yourself as a householder. You didn't need to employ anybody else to do that, and it was comfortable. And it might last about 20 years, and then you'd probably weave another one. And then later I found, by the early 20th century, people started to use mass-produced fishing twine to make the same pattern of seat on the same chair frames. They're quite often green. More recently, I came across recycled bicycle tyre seats, which are fantastically ingenious, really, because once the bicycle tyre was totally worn out, there was no tread left on it, the edges were cut and it was made into the same kind of chair seat as would have had Suguan originally. So the Suguan chair is something which, again, I can trace it right back to the 17th century in written inventories, and then it goes on being produced right up to within living memory in the late 20th century in Ireland.
And another alternative to a wooden seat was the turf seat. How common were they?
Turf seats, again, wonderfully ingenious, but people made whole houses, cabins out of turf. And I suppose if you were clever enough to do that, making a bench or a seat was a simple thing. I mean, you're basically cutting and drying your turf, and it shrinks after it's cut, obviously, as it loses moisture. But then you make something which is a hard, solid seat, quite light in weight, I suppose. I don't know how long they'd last. But there are illustrations of turf beds and turf benches, for example, which I reproduce in my book, from the 1840s. Wood engravings, and the caption says, you know, the man is sitting on a turf bed. So it's a brilliant idea, literally, to cut what you need out of the bog, as well as using it for fuel. And I suppose they've all vanished because they would eventually just get thrown out or burnt.
Finally, one of the objects you write about in the book, and something I think which would be sold by travelling people, is the God in a bottle. Now, describe that to me, because it sounds fascinating.
The God in a bottle, that's an extraordinary, surprising thing. Most people have heard of a ship in a bottle, which is made by a very clever craftsperson, secretly, ingeniously. You know, it has a definite mystique about it. But a God in a bottle was made with the symbols of Christ's passion inside a bottle. So made out of little bits of wood inside the bottle is the cross, the ladder, perhaps, the spear, the axe, all the different things that are symbolic, sometimes a cockerel. And then that's put in a bottle, sometimes filled with water and corked and considered to be full of holy water. This would be sold door to door. We know that travelling people sold them. So the God in a bottle was something, I suppose, really pretty special. There are very few left in museums anyway. And there's a wonderful story from the 1930s from the Irish Folklore Commission manuscripts of a particular person who used to come to the village. And he was known for selling these gods in bottles. So his nickname was God in a Bottle. And when he turned up, everybody would say, oh, look, here comes God in a Bottle. And I suppose the children would cluster around and have a look. And perhaps the woman of the house would be lucky enough to buy one if she could. And then it would be put on display. So the God in a Bottle is an extraordinary, wonderful, beautiful thing. And I managed to reproduce a photograph of four of them from Beamish Museum in Durham in England, which were made by Irish people.
Well, it's a fascinating subject. It's a beautiful book. Thank you for sharing just a small percentage of the wonderful objects depicted and recorded in the book. The book, once again, is called Irish Country Furniture and Furnishings, 1700 to 2000. The author is Claudia Kinmonth. Claudia, many thanks indeed for joining us on the History Show this evening.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.